Hey everybody, welcome to this week's show. I had the distinct pleasure of chatting with today's guest, Ian Ward, a few weeks ago, and I planned this episode specifically for now for a very obvious reason, which you'll hear as we get along in the conversation. Ian was one of the most boisterous people that I've spoken to in all these interviews, so I had like a weirdly wonderful time talking to him about his past few months. So I'm going to stop this introduction a bit early because this conversation is a roller coaster and I'm really excited for you to hear it. Hey Ian, how you doing today? How's it going?
Not great as usual, but I mean, that's to be expected.
Why are you so tired?
Training for the marathon at the moment and building up quite a lot of my legs. It's been a while since I've done distance running.
Yeah. What are you aiming for? What's your time?
So the time I'm aiming for is 2:56. There's a world record with a guy who dresses like a video game character, and I thought I'd try and get that. And I knew it would be difficult, but the more I'm training for it, the more I'm realizing just how vastly difficult it's going to be.
That is quite the achievement. I was training for the Paris Marathon at the beginning of the year. Obviously, it didn't happen for coronavirus reasons, but like 2:56 that's a 6:45 mile or like a 4:12 kilometer for an entire marathon. It's like blistering pace. I think I was trying to get under 4 hours. Can I ask, like, up until now, what has been your personal best marathon time?
So my PB was, I did the London Marathon back in 2013, and I got 3 hours and 33 minutes. Yeah, that was the last super long race that I did. I was just like, all right, enough of this. I was aiming for 3:30, and, you know, 3 minutes off for marathon pace. I was like, that's close enough. I'm very pleased with myself. And I just completely dropped off distance running.
I am always amazed at how fast distance running fitness goes away. Like, I was running 22 miles in February, and I think in April I was just completely gassed at maybe 10. But I mean, 3:33 is a really, really good time. It's very fast, and dropping 36 to 37 minutes, that's insane. That's more than a minute per each mile that you have to do. What's the reason behind all this? Why did you decide to go for this?
So the running time was sort of an additive to make it more interesting, because what the main goal, the main focus, is to actually raise the most amount of money from a charity by running a marathon. Currently, the title holder of that one, his charitable record is 2.5 million pounds.
Wow.
So it's bit of ching chong. So I thought, all right, I need to add something to this to sort of make it more interesting to more people, being like, it's not just one thing, it's also another world record.
What charity are you aiming for?
So I'm splitting it into 4 different charities, and hopefully that's okay hopefully Guinness get back to me and they say, yeah, that's fine. Because if not, I'm in a bit of a pickle. But so the 4 different charities, they're all cancer research charities, but I just made them because I'm sort of spreading this around on social media. I didn't think that it would be something that would be contained within my local area. So I live in London, and, you know, if it was events that I was doing all around London, and that's where I was trying to raise money, I would have just kept it with the Cancer Research UK. But because I was doing it social media platform, I thought I may as well make it as appealing to anyone around the world. So I went on Just Giving, and then I looked to all the charities in English speaking countries, because obviously that's the language that is going to be most appealing, seeing as I don't speak any other language. And I found 4 charities, one in Ireland, one in the UK, one in America, and one in Australia, that were all based around cancer research. So I signed them all into the same sort of pot, in a way.
Why cancer research?
Because I've got cancer myself, and it seemed like the most suitable and fitting thing to make a charitable cause for. It'd be sort of strange if it was like, yeah, I'm I've got cancer and I decided to run a marathon with cancer and all the money goes to dogs.
We kind of breezed by the idea that you have cancer. That's just like a kind of major thing. I'm really sorry to hear that. First of all, you sound very almost normalized to it, but can I ask what kind of cancer? How did you find out? Like, how are you doing? I have so many more questions now.
Yeah, I'd imagine that's a bit of a opening up a Pandora's box of very a lot of different questions that then lead on to further Pandora's box eye. And the way I found it out was by not complete random chance, but it was one of, if not the rarest way to find a tumor, and that was to have a MRI scan that wasn't needed. I was doing a medical trial just to have some beer money, really. And when they did the scan, they got a visual representation of the tumor that was growing in my head. And I had no symptoms to the level that only 3 months ago, before this test, I did a different medical trial. And they had I can't remember what it was exactly called. I got CT scan in my head, but that might be incorrect. But it's a pad that goes on over your head and it measures the brain waves that are going through. And with medical research experts looking at these brain waves, they still didn't detect anything different. So they gave me the green light to go into another medical trial. They always wait 3 months for safety reasons. And then they said, yes, okay, you can go through the testing first to make sure that you are 100% safe to go back on it. Nothing has happened to you within the 3 months. And then they detected the tumor. And then they said, okay, well, what you have is, it looks benign. So you will need to, but you'll need to get it checked by a more specific style of MRI. And that one usually involves, I think it's an iodine liquid, don't quote me on that now, but it's like injected into your bloodstream and it basically makes the tumor more visible. And then when they did the second check, which got delayed because COVID kind of happened at the bad time, and they said, okay, normally we would have you in for your second check, but because of the epidemic that's going on, we're just going to wait a little bit because it might end up being more dangerous for you to come into a hospital. And the second time was a little bit later. It was 6 months later, which should have been shorter, but times we live in. And then the guy who was giving me the diagnosis is a wizard when it comes to brain surgery. He's literally a pioneer how brain surgery is done. His name is Tim Jones. You can look him up and see his list of achievements there if you wish. And he told me the appearance of the tumor hasn't changed. So it still doesn't look cancerous. If it has red dots, it's cancerous. But all tumors in the brain are cancerous. It's just that they haven't developed into that yet. So it's the same way as looking at a caterpillar and going, okay, well, this is a butterfly. Eventually, it will happen.
Can I just ask, with a lot of the facts of what's happening, I'm really curious about you. Like, I don't know, were you scared? Were you like angry? Were you upset? Did this all just like freak you out?
The second time he had the tumor, he was saying, yeah, you're going to have to go into brain surgery. And that was pretty shocking at the time. But within the sort of space of the meeting itself, I kind of calmed down to a more normal sense of normality. And it was just because Tim was breaking it down further. He was like, okay, this is how your life's going to change. This is the chances that it will change this severely. This is the chances that it won't. And, you know, it all seems risky, but it was like, okay, everybody gets hit with some sort of losses. This is nothing that is going to completely tear things down. So it didn't really last that long. To be perfectly honest, I was more concerned with, all right, well, do I tell my friends and family? Or I didn't tell anybody about that other than my housemates, because they had to be on the ball for any seizures that might have happened. But I didn't tell anyone else until the second scan, and they said, you have to go in for surgery. And I was like, oh, I probably am going to have to tell them about this one, because, you know, if I show up for a Christmas dinner and I've got a big scar on the side of my head, like, oh, yeah, that was brain cancer. Don't worry about it. It's sorted.
What did the surgery entail? Like, when you say you had to have surgery, what are we talking about? classic under anesthesia, no idea what's going on.
Because it was affecting my left temporal lobe, the doctor was saying that it will, because I'm right-handed, apparently that made the big difference. Being left-handed, it would have been totally different what that part of my brain controlled. But it then would be affecting my speech and possibly my eyesight. So he was saying the safest way to do this is to do it with an awake surgery where you have not gone under any form of anesthesia. And they will be doing voice testing to me the whole way through so that they're able to do something called, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but basically they have nodes that they put in and then they do the test. And if my speech has deteriorated, they know, okay, well, that's a dangerous area. We don't have to go in there, so let's not go in there. They try to do as little damage as possible while still doing as much as they can. So my chemotherapy is not as severe as many of the other cancers. And my surgery is also not as severe as other forms of cancer, but it's because it's mucking around with your brain, which is your most vital organ.
Okay, so they took the tumor out of your head. And I'm assuming that they checked it. Like, what was the prognosis from that point when they said, okay, cool, we got this thing out. How is Ian going to be?
Yeah, so what they did then was they had they went and they tested the bejesus out of it. And then a week later, when they were doing the biopsies and whatnot, they then came in and they said, so we've been able to look at this closer and it's not what we originally thought. They thought it was a stage one tumor, which meant that it was growing, but it wasn't affecting things. And they said now with certain DNA changes or things that I don't really know about and don't particularly care to find out about really, it's now a stage three. And the way it works is it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 4 switches it into cancer. And once it switches into cancer, that's when the DEFCON count restarts again and it goes cancer stage 1, 2, 3. And I think it goes up to 4 with brain cancer as well. And progressively worse things happen to you. Stage 4 being where things are really terrible. And that's seizures all the time, unable to, you know, move or speak or anything like that. It's just, it's not a good place to be, stage 4. But the rest of them, in a very positive way, I find looking at this, is that stages 1 through 4 of the tumor are all fairly similar in terms of how a human being is able to operate. And then I'm not 100% sure, but I think that the same thing happens with the cancer steps, except stage 4 is where it really starts to get going. So even though I don't have a long diagnosis, most of my time on the earth, on like living, will be quality time. It will be, I'll be able to work out. I'll be able to go on holiday. I'll be able to, you know, live my own life the way I want to.
I think I have to remind myself that you're also training for a marathon right now, like you just said. And like, I'm sitting here listening to you just cover all this ground about your cancer diagnosis. And like, you said this crazy thing just now, which was, with all the years I have left on this earth, did they tell you like, hey, you have this many years left? Because most of us don't know that number.
Yeah, they gave me a number of 1 to 6 years. But they didn't give me that. I asked, like, well, the way that the conversation was kind of going, it was like, all right, this sounds like this isn't going to be, you know, 40s territory. And so I asked in I don't know how it works elsewhere, but in the doctors within the NHS, they have a sort of a job description where they're not allowed to say you've got this long to live. It's that the patient has to ask. And they said, yeah, on paper, you've got this much time, but, and it's a big unknown, but because you, a 31-year-old man who's fit and healthy, went in and found out about this tumor randomly without symptoms, the people that happens to are usually in their 60s because they're getting checkups because of their age. The doctor said that I was one of two people that he's treated in his career. And as you can imagine, if this guy's a pioneer in brain surgery, he does a lot. He does a lot of surgeries. I think he does like 4 to 5 a week. So it's like one surgery every single day. Like he's a conveyor belt of helping people. And he said that I was one of two people who were so young and got a tumor that is never detected. And so the difference, there's little to no research on people like me, because for this to happen and for me to find it out is an incredible rarity. So when they say you got 1/6, it also comes with, you know, two shoulders being shrugged with open hands, where it's like, maybe, because you could have, you know, you could have 20, you could have 30. We really don't know, because your medical situation is incredibly unique.
My original question when we started was, how you feeling? Like, how you doing today? I realized I should re-ask that question now that I know these details. But I mean that a little bit more specifically. Like, you kind of mentioned speech was going to be potentially impacted in the surgery. They were trying to be really careful. Are there any like linguistic experiences that you've run into now? Have you noticed that there has been any effect on your life?
At the moment, no. So like that's a big part of like when people have asked me, like, why am I not really down all the time? And I think it's a combination of a couple of things, but one of the easiest ones to deal with is the fact that it doesn't affect my life at the moment. So there's certain things that are a little bit unpleasant, but then nothing huging more than inconveniences at this stage. Like I can't drink like I used to, and I you know, I'm quite the stereotypical Irishman, and I absolutely love pints. And then there's a load of sports that I can't really do, but that's more to do with the fact that I've committed to this marathon than to what's happened to me. The doctor said that I could go back to jiu-jitsu and it'd actually be fairly safe to have my head be at the risk of some hits. It doesn't actually affect the tumor no more than any brain would be affected by a couple of knocks. It's difficult to be upset when it's not tangible. Also, I kind of sort of have a thought that if I fall into depression and sadness and all that sort of thing, it's the same sort of thing as fear being contagious, where all emotions are contagious. And if I then start doing that, then, you know, my family will start doing that as well. My parents at the moment, you know, they're very worried. So if I'm here sitting around and crying in a bed all the time, like that will fall over onto them and they'll have an awful life. I feel like it's a kind of a duty to not spread around negative emotions, because they do have a knock-on effect. If I'm dealt a poor hand and then I'm perceived to be getting on with it as best that I can, that also has a knock-on effect. And, you know, some people might every so often be like, you know, I have a hangover and I'm not going into work. Like, come on. Like, my friend Ian has cancer and he goes into work every day. So, like, what's my excuse?
That's true. But, I mean, Ian, that's all very brave and really, really noble. But, I mean, you're still a human being and you still have, like, emotions that probably got taxed really aggressively when all this happened. So, I mean, can I just ask you, are you... I mean, look, I don't know how I'm going to go out. I haven't found that out yet. But you know, you have that weird knowledge in your head now that the rest of us don't have, which is, well, potentially this is the way that it goes. So are you scared of dying?
No, I know how it's going to end. So it's all like, it's all the way that I'd actually want. If certain things happen and they're like red lights being like, okay, now is the time that you're going to go out. And while this may come off as, I don't know, deeply saddening or uncomfortable for a lot of people, if you know you're about to die and have a terminal illness that is now at its end stages and it's going to deteriorate really quickly, then you can peacefully like have an assisted, I wouldn't say suicide because it's not a suicide, but you can
go peacefully. You can leave peacefully.
Yeah, exactly. And prior to that, you can have a living funeral. You could say goodbye to people. Like that's a pretty good way to go out, I think, because you can call up the people that you don't like and you can be like, yeah, you've always been a prick, mate. And, you know, you can do all that. You can clear the air as much as possible and you can you can go to certain people and you can say, look, you know, I know I'm on my way out now. And something that's always bothered me is that, you know, in school, even though I never thought I was a bully, I thought about it, and, you know, I did actually bully you. You know, you can sort of do all that sort of thing.
You said a living funeral. What is that exactly?
Oh, a living funeral is basically just a big party. And you just go, right, I've got a one ticket, lads. So, you know, come here and have a good time and say goodbye. And then that's that.
I was going to ask this. So I happen to know a lot of Irish people living in London. Generally speaking, you have to be one of the most jovial Irish people that I've ever met. And that's in addition to the fact that you're living with brain cancer. That's probably pretty impressive, I think. But I have to ask, I mean, you kind of mentioned this earlier, because you're trying to put on this brave face for everybody, which I really appreciate. And you're not going to wallow in self-pity, but like what keeps you going every day? Like every day you have chemotherapy today. You're going to try to run this marathon. You're putting your body through, I guess, these like crazy motions on a top of this crazy disease inside of you. Like what goes through your head on a day where you just can't get out of bed or you just don't feel like you want to? Like what could you tell us who, I mean, our problems are all very, very little, rather, compared to yours. But we all have our days, you know? We all have days where we just don't want to get moving. What do you do? What do you say to yourself?
Oh, I kind of flip it on its head and I start thinking, all right, well, you don't have time to be sitting around and moping. You literally don't have the time to do that. So there's no more, mañana. There's no more of that. So get out of bed, make your bed, go sort your house out, and then get out there and do whatever you can to try and achieve the difficult things that you set out for yourself so that you would have a meaning to get out of bed in the first place. There's not a day that goes by where I sit down and I go, well, there's nothing to do today. But there's far more to do every day than to not do. So I would feel much more guilty than I previously would.
Yeah, you don't have that luxury anymore. I guess the last couple of things I want to ask are just a little bit about your advice or your I guess, call to action is a strange thing to say in this context, but it's exactly what you are trying to put forward here with donating all this money, running this marathon. I mean, living generally, if I may be so bold to say, like a generally happy version of a really unhappy result.
Yeah, that's all fair.
So can I ask just that, like, is there anybody you want to thank, you want to say to people who are listening? It's kind of open-ended, but I don't know, like you live in London, I live in London, we have the NHS. I mean, that's, you probably didn't pay anything for this, which is incredible.
Not a penny. Who was the guy who invented the NHS? He probably deserves a bit of thanks. I know it came up in 1949, just after the World War. But I mean, I never really liked the whole like Oscar winning thing where it's like, thanks, mom. Thanks, dad. It's like, yeah, thanks to all these sort of people. Like there's anyone who's ever had a like gigantic influence on my life, I suppose they are worth thanking. But then there's the question of, well, who really made the influences that got me to where I was, because a lot of those people might be people that I hate because they put me through a lot of heartache and problems. But then because of that, you then have the choice of either being put down or rising above what those problems were and, you know, making yourself better as a person.
We can just say a thank you to Aniran Bevan, who is the person who invented the NHS. Just for a little factoid for everybody.
Do you Google it there?
I did Google it. Yes, I did. Okay, final question then. What can we do? Me, the people listening?
The easiest way is definitely, so because it's early stages and the money is vast, by far the most important thing is to get the message out as much as possible, because donations are great. They're very welcome. But the actual far more important thing is to make sure that the audience is absolutely huge. I don't have the maths right to hand, but I remember breaking down like, okay, if everyone gives a fiver, that's not a huge amount of money. And it would be something like 700,000 people that would all have to give a fiver. So getting a gigantic amount of people that are aware of this is the most important thing right now. And the way you can do that is if you type in cancer, not cancer, into Facebook, and then Liam TW, and then anything to do with marathon and cancer makes me pop up on YouTube. I think there's a few Liam TWs. Then if you want to directly just go to justgiving.com/fundraising and then Ian, which is spelled I-A-I-N, hyphenated, Ward, W-A-R-D, 2, 3, 4, or 5. Not altogether, but one of those things. If you forget about any of that, if you just look in bios of, you know, the Facebook or the YouTube or the Twitter, they all sort of interlink with each other.
I'll put all that stuff in the show notes. So if you're listening to this like right now, immediately just go to your show notes. All the links will be there. Click right away, follow, donate, do all the things. Ian, it's quite the story, quite the journey that we've come on here from just how your training is going. So can I just ask before we go, what's your next mileage that you're going to run?
I do a half marathon every weekend with my mate, Bren. And we kind
as
of
you document, do.
Yeah, as you do, document that as much as possible. So I'll be doing a half marathon this weekend, but that's the largest amount of mileage that I will do because during the chemotherapy, the way it affects your body is your body doesn't heal as well as it used to. So it wouldn't really be wise to try and push my body to its limits as much as possible. So trying to keep it more about teaching the willpower than teaching the body.
Right. Okay. Casual half marathon while on chemotherapy. If anybody out there is still figuring out, you know, oh, what am I going to do? I'm so lazy. Can't seem to get out and work out anymore. Coronavirus is tough. They have you to look forward to. Ian, thank you so much for joining me. This was incredible.
Yeah, well, glad I was interesting in some way.
The day I recorded this outro, I recalled Ian's tale about not wasting any days, and I got up from my desk and immediately went to do a workout. The fact that Ian has had a brain tumor and subsequent brain surgery, yet somehow is as upbeat as he is with the pending escalation of a disease hurtling towards him is, frankly, astounding. I also want to note that Ian, like me, lives in the UK, and Ian, like me, takes part in the National Health Service, or NHS. Ian spent £0 on his treatments, surgery, and appointments, something that I could not say if I still lived in my home country of the US. I thought about the care and benefit that I might have wanted in case of any health issues, and how if I didn't have the right type of insurance, just how much that might have cost me. Maybe it's not a brain tumor, but hey, we're in a pandemic at the moment too, so how much should a ventilator cost? So, as a sign-off, since we're really close to election day, please, please, please make sure that you're registered to vote and have a safe way to cast your ballot. That's it for today's story. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, you can subscribe to get the latest updates anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment and you're feeling generous, please leave a review. I'd really appreciate it, and it helps me understand how to make this show even better. For more info on me and this concept, you can visit our website at onesimplequestion.co. One Simple Question is hosted by me, Abhishek Lahoti. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you tune in again soon, and bye for now.